used to it, the pain lessens and the dreams deepen. Astonishing. Commonplace, said the merchant. Quite a few men and women in Talvera keep one close at hand, even if they don't speak of it in public. The effect is as pleasing as liquor, yet ultimately far less costly. Locke scratched his chin. Never had to stab myself with a bottle of wine, though. And this isn't just some ruse, some amusement for visitors who wouldn't know any better? The merchant's smile broadened. He extended his right arm and pulled back the sleeve of his cloak. The dark skin of his slender forearm was dotted with little circular scars. I would never offer a product for which I was not prepared to vouch myself. Admirable, said Locke, and fascinating, but perhaps there are some customs of Talvera best left unexplored. To your own tastes be true. Still smiling, the man pulled his cloak sleeve back up and folded his hands before him. After all, a scorpion hawk was never to your liking, Master Lamora. Locke felt a sudden cold pressure in his chest. He flicked a glance at Jean and found the larger man instantly tense as well. Struggling to maintain his outward calm, Locke cleared his throat. I beg your pardon? I'm sorry. The merchant blinked at him guilelessly. I merely wished you a pleasant night, gentlemen. Right. Locke eyed him for a moment or two longer, then stepped back, turned on his heel, and began to walk across the night market once more. Jean was at his side immediately.
You heard that, whispered Locke.
Very clearly, said Jean. I wonder who our friendly scorpion merchant works for.
It's not just him, muttered Locke. The fruit seller called me Lamora as well. You didn't hear that one, but I damn well did.
Shit. Want to double back and grab one of them?
Going somewhere, Master Lamora?
Locke almost whirled on the middle-aged female merchant who stepped toward them from their right. He managed to keep the 6-inch stiletto concealed up his coat sleeve from flying reflexively into his hand. Jean put one arm beneath the back of his coat.
You seem to be mistaken, madam, said Locke. My name is Leocanto Costa.
The woman made no further move toward them. She merely smiled and chuckled.
Lamora, Locke Lamora.
Jean Tenen, said the scorpion merchant, who had stepped out from behind his little cage-covered table. Other merchants were moving slowly behind them, staring fixedly at Locke and Jean.
There seems to be a, misunderstanding afoot, said Jean.
He slid his right hand back out from under his coat. Locke knew from long experience that the head of one of his hatchets would be cupped in his palm, with the handle concealed up his sleeve.
No misunderstanding, said the scorpion merchant.
Thorn of Camor,
said a little girl who stepped out to block their progress toward the Savrola side of the great gallery.
Thorn of Camor, said the middle-aged woman.
Gentlemen bastards, said the scorpion merchant, far from home.
Locke glanced around, his heart hammering in his chest. Deciding that the time for discretion was past, he let his stiletto fall into his itching fingers. All the merchants in the night market seemed to have taken an interest in them. They were surrounded, and the merchants were slowly tightening the circle. They cast long, dark shadows upon the stones at Locke and Jean's feet. Was Locke imagining things, or were some of the lights dimming? Already the night gallery seemed darker. Damn, some of the lanterns were indeed going out right before his eyes.
That is far enough.
Jean let his hatchet fall visibly into his right hand. He and Locke pressed their backs against one another.
No closer, shouted Locke. Cut the weird shit, or there's going to be blood.
There has already been blood, said the little girl.
Locke Lamora, muttered a soft chorus of the people surrounding them.
"There has already been blood, Loch Lamora," said the middle-aged woman.
The last alchemical lanterns within the periphery of the night market dimmed, the last few fires banked down, and now Locke and Jean faced the circle of merchants solely by the wan light coming from the inner harbour and from the eerie flicker of distant lamps beneath the vast, deserted gallery, much too far away for comfort. The little girl took one last step toward them, her eyes grey and unblinking.
"Master Lamora, Master Tannen," she said in her clear, soft voice. "The Falconer of Carthane sends his regards."
6. Locke stared at the little girl, jaw half open. She glided forward like an apparition until just 2 paces separated them. Locke felt a pang of foolishness at holding a stiletto on a girl not yet 3 feet high, but then she smiled coldly in the near darkness, and the malice behind that smile steadied his hand on the hilt of the blade. The little girl reached up to touch her chin.
"Though he cannot speak," she said.
"Though he cannot speak for himself," chorused the circle of merchants, now motionless in the darkness.
"Though he is mad," said the girl, slowly spreading her hands toward Locke and Jean, palms out.
"Mad beyond measure," whispered the circle.
"His friends remain," said the girl. "His friends remember."
Jean moved beside Locke, and then both of his hatchets were out, blackened steel heads naked to the night.
"These people are puppets. There are bonds magi somewhere around us," he hissed.
"Show yourselves, you fucking cowards," said Locke, speaking to the girl.
"We show our power," she replied.
"What more do you need?"
whispered the chorus in their ragged circle, their eyes empty as reflecting pools.
"What more do you need to see, Master Lamora?"
The little girl gave a sinister parody of a curtsy.
"Whatever you want," said Locke. "Leave these people out of it. Just fucking talk to us. We don't want to hurt these people."
"Of course, Master Lamora. Of course," whispered the circle. "Of course, that's the point," said the girl. "So you must hear what we have to say."
"State your God's damned business, then."
"You must answer," said the girl.
"Answer for the Falconer," said the chorus.
"You must answer, both of you."
"Of all the... fuck you," said Locke, his voice rising to a shout. "We did answer for the Falconer. Our answer was 10 lost fingers and a lost tongue for 3 dead friends. You got him back alive, and it was more than he deserved."
"Not for you to judge," hissed the girl.
"Judge the Magi of Carthane," whispered the circle.
"Not for you to judge, nor for you to presume a grasp of our laws," said the girl.
"All the world knows it's death to slay a bondsmage," said Jean. "That and little else. We let him live and took pains to return him to you. Our business is ended. If you wanted a more complicated treatment than that, you should have sent a fucking letter."
"This is not business," said the girl.
"But personal," said the circle.
"Personal," repeated the girl. "A brother has been bloodied. We cannot let this stand unanswered."
"You sons of bitches," said Locke. "You really think you're fucking gods, don't you? I didn't mug the Falconer in an alley and take his purse. He helped murder my friends. I'm not sorry he's mad, and I'm not sorry for the rest of you. Kill us and get on with your business, or piss off and let these people go free."
"No,"
said the scorpion merchant. A whispered chorus of "No!" came from around the circle.
"Cowards! Pissants!"
Jean pointed one of his hatchets at the little girl as he spoke. "You can't scare us with this penny theater bullshit."
"If you force us to," said Locke, "we'll fight you with the weapons in our hands all the way to Carthane. You bleed like the rest of us. Seems to me all you can do is kill us."
"No," said the girl, giggling. "We can do worse," said the fruit seller.
"We can let you live," said the scorpion merchant.
"Live? Uncertain," said the girl.
"Uncertain," said the chorus of merchants as they began to step backward, widening their circle.
"Watched," said the girl.
"Followed," said the circle.
"Now wait," said the girl. "Run your little games and chase your little fortunes."
"And wait," whispered the chorus. "Wait for our answer. Wait for our time."
"You are always in our reach," said the little girl. "And you are always in our sight."
"Always,"
whispered the circle, slowly dispersing back to their stalls, back to the positions they'd held just a few minutes earlier.
"You will meet misfortune," said the little girl as she slipped away. "For the falconer of Carthane."
Locke and Jean said nothing as the merchants around them resumed their places in the night market, as the lanterns and barrel fires gradually rose once more to flush the area with warm light. Then the affair was ended. The merchants resumed their former attitudes of keen interest or watchful boredom, and the babble of conversation rose up around them again. Locke and Jean slipped their weapons out of sight before anyone seemed to notice them.
"Gods," said Jean, shuddering visibly.
"I suddenly feel," Locke said quietly, "that I didn't drink nearly enough from that bloody carousel." There was mist at the edges of his vision. He put a hand to his cheeks and was surprised to find himself crying.
"Bastards,"
he muttered.
"Infants! Wretched, cowardly show-offs!"
"Yes," said Jean. Locke and Jean began to walk forward once again, glancing warily around. The little girl who had done most of the speaking for the bonds magi was now sitting beside an elderly man, sorting through little baskets of dried figs under his supervision. She smiled shyly as they passed.
"I hate them," whispered Locke. "I hate this. Do you think they've really got something planned for us, or was that just a put-on?"
"I suppose it works either way," said Jean with a sigh.
"Gods, strapiti! Do we flinch, or do we keep betting? Worst case, we've got a few thousand solari on record at the spire. We could cash out, take a ship, be gone before noon tomorrow."
"Where to?"
"Anywhere else.
There's no running from these assholes, not if they're serious."
"Yes, but..."
"Fuck Carthane!" Locke clenched his fists. "You know, I think I understand. I think I understand how the Grey King could feel the way he did. I've never even been there. But if I could smash Carthane, burn the fucking place, make the sea swallow it, I'd do it. Gods help me, I'd do it."
Jean suddenly came to a complete stop. "There's another problem, Locke. Gods forgive me."
"What?"
"Even if you stay, I shouldn't. I'm the one who should be gone, as far from you as possible."
"What the fuck nonsense is this?"
"They know my name."
Jean grabbed Locke by his shoulders, and Locke winced. That stone-hard grip didn't agree with the old wound beneath his left clavicle. Jean immediately realized his mistake and loosened his fingers, but his voice remained urgent.
"My real name, and they can use it.
They can make me a puppet, like these poor people. I'm a threat to you every moment I'm around you. I don't bloody well care that they know your name. Are you mad? No, but you're still drunk, and you're not thinking straight. I certainly am. Do you want to leave? No, gods no, of course not. But I'm shutting up right this second if you know what's good for you. You need to understand that you're in danger. Of course I'm in danger. I'm mortal. Jean, gods love you, I will not fucking send you away, and I will not let you send yourself away. We lost Carlo, Galdo, and Bug. If I send you away, I lose the last friend I have in the world. Who wins then, Jean? Who's protected then? Jean's shoulders slumped, and Locke suddenly felt the beginning of the transition from fading inebriation to pounding headache. He groaned. Jean, I will never stop feeling awful for what I put you through in Vel Verazzo. And I will never forget how long you stayed with me when you should have tied weights around my ankles and thrown me in the bay. Gods help me, I will never be better off without you. I don't care how many bondsmage I know your damned name. I wish I could be sure you knew best about this. This is our life, said Locke. This is our game, that we've put 2 years into. That's our fortune waiting for us to steal it at the Sin Spire. That's all our hopes for the future. So fuck Carthane. They want to kill us. We can't stop them. So what else can we do? I won't jump at shadows on account of those bastards. On with it. Both of us together. Most of the night market merchants had taken note of the intensity of Locke and Jean's private conversation, and had avoided making further pitches. But one of the last merchants on the northern fringe of the night market was either less sensitive or more desperate for a sale, and called out to them.
"Carved amusements, gentlemen? Something for a woman or a child in your lives? Something artful from the city of artifice?"
The man had dozens of exotic little toys on an upturned crate. His long, ragged brown coat was lined on the inside with quilted patches in a multitude of garish colours, orange, purple, cloth of silver, mustard yellow. He dangled the painted wood figure of a spear-carrying soldier by 4 cords from his left hand, and with little gestures of his fingers he made the figure thrust at an imaginary enemy.
"A marionette? A little puppet for memory of Tal Verar?"
Jean stared at him for a few seconds before responding.
"For memory of Tal Verar," he said quietly, "I would want anything, beg pardon, before I would want a puppet."
Locke and Jean said nothing else to each other. With an ache around his heart to match the one growing in his head, Locke followed the bigger man out of the great gallery and into the Savrola, eager to be back behind high walls and locked doors, for what little it might prove to be worth. Reminiscence, The Cape of Vel Verazzo. 1. Locke Lamora had arrived in Vel Verazzo nearly 2 years earlier, wanting to die, and Jean Tannen had been inclined to let him have his wish. Vel Verazzo is a deep-water port about 100 miles southeast of Tal Verar, carved out of the high rocky cliffs that dominate the mainland coast on the Sea of Brass. A city of 8,000 or 9,000 souls, it has long been a sullen tributary of the Verari, ruled by a governor appointed directly by the Archon. A line of narrow elderglass spires rises 200 feet out of the water just offshore, one more eldrin artifact of inscrutable function on a coast thick with abandoned wonders. The glass pylons have 15-foot platforms atop them, and are now used as lighthouses, manned by petty convicts. Boats will leave them to climb up the knotted rope ladders that hang down the pylons. That accomplished, they winch up their provisions and settle in for a few weeks of exile, tending red alchemical lamps the size of small huts. Not all of them come back down right in the head, or live to come back down at all. 2 years before that fatal game of Carousel Hazard,
A heavy galleon swept in toward Vel Verazzo under the red glow of those offshore lights. The hands atop the galleon's yardarms waved, half in pity and half in jest, at the lonely figures atop the pylons. The sun had been swallowed by thick clouds on the western horizon, and a soft, dying light rippled across the water beneath the first stars of evening. A warm, wet breeze was blowing from shore to sea, and little threads of mist seemed to be leaking out of the grey rocks to either side of the old port town. The galleon's yellowed canvas topsails were close-reefed as she prepared to lay to about half a mile offshore. A little harbour-master's skiff scudded out to meet the galleon, green and white lanterns bobbing on its bow to the rhythm of the eight heaving oarsmen.
"What vessel?"
The harbour-master stood up beside her bow lanterns and shouted through a speaking trumpet from 30 yards away.
"Golden Gain! Talvera!"
came the return shout from the galleon's waist.
"Do you wish to put in?"
"No, passengers only, coming off by boat."
The lower stern cabin of the Golden Chain smelled strongly of sweat and illness. Jean Tannen was newly returned from the upper deck and had lost some of his tolerance for the odour, which lent further edge to his bad mood. He flung a patched blue tunic at Locke and folded his arms.
"For fuck's sake," he said, "we're here. We're getting off this bloody ship and back onto good solid stone. Put the bloody tunic on. They're lowering a boat."
Locke shook the tunic out with his right hand and frowned. He was sitting on the edge of a bunk, dressed only in his breeches, and was thinner and dirtier than Jean had ever seen him. His ribs stood out beneath his pale skin like the hull timbers of an unfinished ship. His hair was dark with grease, long and unkempt on every side, and a fine thistle of beard fringed his face. His upper left arm was crisscrossed with the glistening red lines of barely sealed wounds. There was a scabbed puncture on his left forearm, and beneath that a dirty cloth brace was wound around his wrist. His left hand was a mess of fading bruises. A discoloured bandage partially covered an ugly-looking injury on his left shoulder, a scant few inches above his heart. Their 3 weeks at sea had done much to reduce the swelling of Locke's cheeks, lips, and broken nose, but he still looked as though he'd tried to kiss a kicking mule, repeatedly.
"Can I get a hand, then?"
"No, you can do it for yourself. You should have been exercising this past week, getting ready. I can't always be here to hover about like your fairy fucking nursemaid."
"Well, let me shove a goddamned rapier through your shoulder and wiggle it for you, and then let's see how keen you are to exercise."
"I took my cuts, you sobbing pisswallow, and I did exercise them."
Jean lifted his own tunic. Above the substantially reduced curve of his once prodigious belly was the fresh, livid scar of a long slash across his ribs.
"I don't care how much it hurts. You have to move around, or they heal tight like a cork seal, and then you're really in the shit."
"So you keep telling me."
Locke threw the shirt down on the deck beside his bare feet.
"But unless that tunic animates itself, or you do the honours, it seems I go to the boat like this."
"Sun's going down. Summer or not, it's going to be cool out there. But if you want to be an idiot, I guess you do go like that."
"You're a son of a bitch, Jean."
"If you were healthy, I'd re-break your nose for that, you self-pitying little—"
"Gentlemen?"
A crewwoman's muffled voice came through the door, followed by a loud knock.
"Captain's compliments, and the boat is ready."
"Thank you," yelled Jean.
He ran a hand through his hair and sighed.
"Why did I bother saving your life again? I could have brought the Grey King's corpse. Would have been better fucking company."
"Please," said Locke forcefully, gesturing with his good arm. "We can meet in the middle. I'll pull with my good arm and you handle the bad side. Get me off this ship and I'll get to exercising."
"Can't come soon enough," said Jean,
and after another moment's hesitation he bent down for the tunic. 2.
Jean's tolerance rose for a few days with their release from the wet, smelly, heaving world of the galleon. Even for paying customers, long-distance sea transit still had more in common with a prison sentence than a vacation. With their handful of silver volani, converted from Komori Solons at an extortionate rate by the first mate of the Golden Gain, who'd argued that it was still preferable to the numismatic mugging they'd get from the town's money-changers, he and Locke secured a third-floor room at the Silver Lantern, a sagging old inn on the waterfront. Jean immediately set about securing a source of income. If Camor's underworld had been a deep lake, Vel Virazzo's was a stagnant pond. He had little trouble sussing out the major dockside gangs and the relationships between them. There was little organization in Vel Virazzo, and no boss of bosses to screw things up. A few nights of drinking in all the right dives, and he knew exactly who to approach. They called themselves the Brass Coves, and they skulked about in an abandoned tannery down on the city's eastern docks, where the sea lapped against the pilings of rotting piers that had seen no legitimate use in 20 years. By night, they were an active crew of sneak thieves, muggers, and coat-charmers. By day, they slept, diced, and drank away most of their profits. Jean kicked in their door, though it hung loosely in its frame and wasn't locked, at the second hour of the afternoon on a bright, sunny day. There were an even dozen of them in the old tannery, young men between the ages of 15 and 20-odd, standard membership for a local trouble sort of gang. Those who weren't awake were slapped back to consciousness by their associates as Jean strolled into the center of the tannery floor. "Good afternoon." He gave a slight bow from the neck, then spread his arms wide. "Who's the biggest, meanest motherfucker here? Who's the best bruiser in the Brass Coves?" After a few seconds of silence and surprised stares, a relatively stocky young man with a crooked nose and a shaved head leapt down onto the dusty floor from an open staircase. The boy walked up to Jean and smirked.
"You're looking at him?"
Jean nodded, smiled, then whipped both of his arms around so that his cupped hands cracked against both of the boy's ears. He staggered, and Jean took a firm hold of his head, lacing his fingers tightly behind the rear arch of his skull. He pulled the tough's head sharply downward and fed him a knee, once, twice, three times. As the boy's face met Jean's kneecap for the last time, Jean let go, and the tough sprawled backward on the tannery floor, senseless as a side of cold, salted meat. "Wrong," said Jean, not even breathing heavily. "I'm the meanest motherfucker here. I'm the biggest bruiser in the Brass Coves."
"You ain't in the Brass Coves, asshole!"
shouted another boy, who nonetheless had a look of awed disquiet on his face.
"Let's kill this piece of shit!"
A third boy, wearing a tattered four-cornered cap and a set of handmade necklaces threaded with small bones, darted toward Jean with a stiletto drawn back in his right hand. When the thrust came, Jean stepped back, caught the boy by the wrist, and yanked him forward into a back fist from his other hand. While the boy spat blood and tried to blink tears of pain from his eyes, Jean kicked him in the groin, then swept his legs out from under him. The boy's stiletto appeared in Jean's left hand as if by magic, and he twirled it slowly.
"Surely you boys can do simple sums," he said. 1 + 1 = don't fuck with me."
The boy who'd charged at him with the knife sobbed, then threw up.
"Let's talk taxes."
Jean walked around the periphery of the tannery floor, kicking over a few empty wine bottles. There were dozens of them scattered around.
"Looks like you boys pull in enough coin to eat and drink. That's good. I'll have 40% of it, cold metal. I don't want goods. You'll pay your taxes every other day, starting today. Cough up your purses and turn out your pockets."
"Fuck that!"
Jean stalked toward the boy who'd spoken. The youth was standing against the far wall of the tannery with his arms crossed.
don't like it? Hit me, then.
You don't think that's fair? You mug people for a living, right? Make a fist, son.
Jean grabbed him, spun him around, took hold of him by his neck and by the top of his breeches, and rammed him headfirst into the thick wood of the tannery's outer wall several times. The boy hit the ground with a thud when Jean let go. He was unable to fight back when Jean patted down his tunic and came up with a small leather purse.
"Added penalty," said Jean, "for damaging the wall of my tannery with your head."
He emptied the purse into his own, then tossed it back down beside the boy.
"All of you get down here and line up." "Line up! 4/10 isn't much. Be honest. You can guess what I'll do if I find out that you're not."
"Who the hell are you?"
The first boy to approach Jean with coins in his hand offered up the question along with the money.
"You can call me..."
As Jean began to speak, the boy conjured a dagger in his other hand, dropped the coins, and lunged. The bigger man shoved the boy's extended arm to the outside, bent nearly in half, and slammed his right shoulder into the boy's stomach. He then lifted the boy effortlessly on his shoulder and dropped him over his back, so that the boy struck the floor of the tannery nearly face first. He ended up writhing in pain beside the last cove who'd pulled a blade on Jean.
"Callous. Tavern callous, actually."
Jean smiled.
"That was a good thought, coming at me while I was talking. That at least I can respect."
Jean shuffled backwards several paces to block the door.
"But it seems to me that the subtle philosophical concept I'm attempting to descant upon may be going over your heads. Do I really have to kick all your asses before you take the hint?"
There was a chorus of mutterings and a healthy number of boys shaking their heads, however reluctantly.
"Good."
The extortion went smoothly after that. Jean wound up with a satisfying collection of coins, surely enough to keep him and Locke ensconced at their inn for another week.
"I'm off, then. Rest easy and work well tonight. I'll be back tomorrow at the second hour of the afternoon. We can start talking about how things are going to be now that I'm the new boss of the Brass Coves."
3. Naturally, they all armed themselves, and at the second hour of the afternoon the next day, they were waiting in ambush for Jean. To their surprise, he strolled into the old tannery with a Velverazzo constable at his side. The woman was tall and muscular, dressed in a plum-purple coat reinforced with a lining of fine iron chain. She had brass epaulettes on her shoulders and long brown hair pulled back in a tight swordswoman's tail with brass rings. 4 more constables took up a position just outside the door. They wore similar coats, but also carried long, lacquered sticks and heavy wooden shields slung over their backs.
"Hello, lads," said Jean.
All around the room, daggers, stilettos, broken bottles, and sticks were disappearing from sight.
"I'm sure some of you recognize Prefect Levasto and her men."
"Boys,"
said the prefect offhandedly, hooking her thumbs into her leather sword belt. Alone of all the constables, she carried a cutlass in a plain black sheath.
"Prefect Levasto," said Jean, "is a wise woman, and she leads wise men. They happen to enjoy money, which I am now providing as a consideration for the hardship and tedium of their duties. If anything should chance to happen to me, why, they would lose a new source of the very thing they enjoy."
"It would be heartbreaking," said the prefect.
"And it would have consequences," said Jean.
The prefect set one of her boots on an empty wine bottle and applied steady pressure until it shattered beneath her heel.
"Heartbreaking,"
she repeated with a sigh.
"I'm sure you're all bright lads," said Jean. "I'm sure you've all enjoyed the prefect's visit."
"Shouldn't like to have to repeat it,"
said Levasto with a grin. She turned slowly and ambled back out the door. The sound of her squad marching away soon receded into the distance. The brass coves looked down at Jean glumly. The four boys closest to the door, with their hands behind their backs, were the ones wearing livid black and green bruises from before.
"Why the fuck are you doing this to us?" grumbled one of them.
"I'm not your enemy, boys. Believe it or not, I think you'll really come to appreciate what I can do for you. Now shut up and listen." "First," said Jean, raising his voice so everyone could hear, "I'd like to say that it's rather sad how long you've been around without getting the city watch on the take. They were so eager for it when I made the offer. Like sad, neglected little puppies." Jean was wearing a long black vest over a stained white tunic. He reached up beneath his back, under the vest, with his right hand. "But," he continued, "at least the fact that your first thought was to kill me shows some spirit. Let's see those toys again. Come on, show 'em off." Sheepishly, the boys drew out their weapons once again, and Jean inspected them with a sweep of his head. Gimp steel, broken bottles, little sticks, a hammer. Boys, the trouble with this setup is that you think those are threats. They're not. They're insults." He started moving while the last few words were still coming out of his mouth. His left hand slid up beneath his vest beside his right. Both of his arms came out and up in a blur, and then he grunted as he let fly with both of his hatchets overhand. There was a pair of half-full wineskins hanging on pegs on the far wall. Each one exploded in a gout of cheap Ferrari red that spattered several boys nearby. Jean's hatchets had impaled the wineskins dead center and stuck in the wood behind them without quivering.
"That was a threat," he said, cracking his knuckles. "And that's why you now work for me. Anyone else really want to dispute that at this point?"
The boys standing closest to the wineskins edged backward as Jean stepped over and wrenched his hatchets out of the wall.
"Didn't think so. But don't take it amiss," Jean continued. "It works in your favor, too. A boss needs to protect what's his if he's going to stay the boss. If anyone other than me tries to shove you around, let me know. I'll pay them a visit. That's my job."
The next day, the brass coves grudgingly lined up to pay their taxes. The last boy in line, as he dropped his copper coins into Jean's hands, muttered,
"You said you'd help if someone else gave us the business. Some of the coves got kicked around this morning by the black sleeves from over on the north side."
Jean nodded sagely and slipped his takings into his coat pocket. The next night, after making inquiries, he sauntered into a north side dive called the Sign of the Brimming Cup. The only thing the tavern was brimming with was thugs, a good 7 or 8 of them, all with dirty black cloths tied around the arms of their jackets and tunics. They were the only customers, and they looked up with suspicion as he closed the door behind him and carefully slid home the wooden bolt.
"Good evening."
He smiled and cracked his knuckles.
"I'm curious. Who's the biggest, meanest motherfucker in the black sleeves?"
The day after that, he collected his taxes from the brass coves with the bruised knuckles of his right hand wrapped in a poultice. For the first time, most of the boys paid enthusiastically. A few even started to call him Tav. 4. But Locke did not exercise his wounds as he'd promised. Locke's thin supply of coins was parcelled out for wine. His poison of choice was a particularly cheap local slop. More purple than red, with a bouquet like turpentine, its scent soon saturated the room he shared with Jean at the Silver Lantern. Locke took it constantly for the pain. Jean remarked one evening that his pain must be increasing as the days went on, for the empty skins and bottles were multiplying proportionally. They quarrelled, or more accurately rekindled their ongoing quarrel, and Jean stomped off into the night, for neither the first nor the last time. Those first few days in Vel Virazzo, Locke would totter down the steps to the common room some nights, where he would play a few desultory hands of cards with some of the locals. He conned them mirthlessly with whatever fast fingers tricks he could manage with just one good hand. Soon enough they began to shun his games and his bad attitude, and he retreated back to the third floor to drink alone in silence. Food and cleanliness remained afterthoughts. Jean tried to get a dog-leech in to examine Locke's wounds, but Locke drove the man out with a string of invective that made Jean, whose speech could be colourful enough to strike fire from damp tinder, blush.
"Of your friend I can find no trace," said the man. "He seems to have been eaten by one of the thin, hairless apes from the Ocanti Isles. All it does is screech at me. What became of the last leech to take a look at him?"
"We left him in Talisham," said Jean. "I'm afraid my friend's attitude moved him to bring an early end to his own sea voyage."
"Well, I might have done the same. I waive my fee in profound sympathy. Keep your silver. You shall need it for wine or poison."
More and more, Jean found himself spending time with the Brass Coves for no better reason than to avoid Locke. A week passed, then another. Tavrin Callas was becoming a known and solidly respected figure in Vel Virazzo's crooked fraternity. Jean's arguments with Locke became more circular, more frustrating, more pointless. Jean instinctively recognized the downward arc of terminal self-pity, but had never dreamed that he'd have to drag Locke, of all people, out of it. He avoided the problem by training the coves. At first he passed on just a few hints— how to use simple hand signals around strangers, how to set distractions before picking pockets, how to tell real gems from paste and avoid stealing the latter. Inevitably, he began to receive respectful entreaties to show them a thing or two of the tricks he'd used to pound four coves into the ground. First in line with these requests were the four who'd been pounded. A week after that, the alchemy was fully underway. Half a dozen boys were rolling around in the dust of the tannery floor while Jean coached them on all the essentials—leverage, initiative, situational awareness. He began to demonstrate the tricks, both merciful and cruel, that had kept him alive over half a lifetime spent making his points with his fists and hatchets. Under Jean's influence, the boys began to take more of an interest in the state of their old tannery. He explicitly encouraged them to start viewing it as a headquarters, which demanded certain comforts. Alchemical lanterns appeared hanging from the rafters. Fresh oil paper was nailed up over the broken windows, and new planks and straw were raised up to the roof to plug holes. The boys stole cushions, cheap tapestries, and portable shelves.
"Find me a hearthstone," said Jean. "Steal me a big one. And I'll teach you poor little bastards how to cook, too. You can't beat Camor for chefs. Even the thieves are chefs back there. I had years of training."
He stared around at the increasingly well-maintained tannery, at the increasingly eager band of young thieves living in it, and he spoke wistfully to himself.
"We all did."
He'd tried to interest Locke in the project of the Brass Coves, but had been rebuffed. That night he tried again, explaining about their ever-increasing nightly take, their headquarters, the tips and training he was giving them. Locke stared at him for a long time, sitting on the bed with a chipped glass half full of purple wine in his hands.
"Well," he said at last, "well, I can see you've found your replacements, haven't you?"
Jean was too startled to say anything. Locke drained his glass and continued, his voice flat and humourless.
"That was certainly quick, quicker than I expected. A new gang, a new burrow. Not a glass one, but you can probably fix that if you look around long enough. So here you are, playing Father Chains, lighting a fire under that kettle of happy horse shit all over again."
Jean exploded across the room and slapped the empty glass out of Locke's hand. It shattered against the wall and showered half the room with glittering fragments. But Locke didn't even blink. Instead, he leaned back against his sweat-stained pillows and sighed.
"Got any twins yet? How about a new Sabbatha? A new me?"
"To hell with you!"
Jean clenched his fists until he could feel the warm, slick blood seeping out beneath his nails.
"To hell with you, Locke! I didn't save your god's-damned life so you could sulk in this god's-damned hovel and pretend you're the man who invented grief. You're not that god's-damned special."
"Why did you save me, then, Saint Jean?"
"Of all the stupid fucking questions!"
"Why?"
Locke heaved himself up off the bed and shook his fists at Jean. The effect would have been comical, but all the murder in the world was in his eyes.
"I told you to leave me! Am I supposed to be grateful for this? This bloody room?"
"I didn't make this room your whole world, Locke. You did.
This is what I was rescued for? 3 weeks sick at sea and now Velvirazzo, asshole of Tal Verar? It's the joke of the gods, and I'm the punchline. Dying with the Grey King was better. I told you to fucking leave me there."
"And I miss them," he said, his voice nearly a whisper. "Gods, I miss them. It's my fault they're dead. I can't stand it." "Don't you dare," growled Jean.
He shoved Locke in the chest, forcefully. Locke fell backward across his bed and hit the wall of the room hard enough to rattle the window shutters.
"Don't you dare use them as an excuse for what you're doing to yourself. Don't you fucking dare!"
Without another word, Jean spun on his heels, walked out the door, and slammed it behind him. 5. Locke sank down against the bed, put his face in his hands, and listened to the creak of Jean's footsteps recede from the hall outside. To his surprise, that creak returned a few minutes later, growing steadily louder. Jean threw the door open, face grim, and marched directly over to Locke with a tall wooden bucket of water in his hands. Without warning, he threw this all over Locke, who gasped in surprise and fell backward against the wall again. He shook his head like a dog and pushed his sopping hair out of his eyes.
"Jean, are you out of your fucking—"
"You needed a bath," Jean interrupted. "You were covered in self-pity." He threw the bucket down and moved around the room, plucking up any bottle or wineskin that still contained liquid. He was finished before Locke realized what he was doing. He then swiped Locke's coin purse from the room's little table and tossed a thin leather package down in its place.
"Hey, Jean! Jean, you can't! That's mine!"
"Used to be ours," said Jean coldly. "I liked that better." When Locke tried to jump up from the bed again, Jean pushed him back down effortlessly. He then stormed out once more and pulled the door shut behind him. There was a curious clicking noise, and then nothing, not even a creak on the floorboards. Jean was waiting right outside the door. Snarling, Locke moved across the room and tried to pull the door open, but it held fast in its frame. He frowned in puzzlement and rattled it a few more times. The bolt was on this side, and it wasn't shot.
"It's a curious fact," Jean said through the door, "that the rooms of the Silver Lantern can be locked from the outside with a special key only the innkeeper has. In case he wants to keep an unruly guest at bay while he calls for the watch, you see."
"Jean, open this fucking door!"
"No, you open it."
"I can't! You told me yourself you've got the special key!"
"The Loch Lomora I used to know would spit on you," said Jean. "Priest of the Crooked Warden, Garista of the Gentleman Bastards, student of Father Chains, brother to Carlo, Galdo, and Bug, tell me, what would Sabbatha think of you?"
"You bastard! Open this door!"
Look at yourself, Locke. You're a fucking disgrace. Open it yourself.
You have the God's damned motherfucking key!
You know how to charm a lock, right? I left you some picks on the table. You want your wine back, you work the bloody door yourself.
You son of a bitch!
My mother was a saint, said Jean. The sweetest jewel Camor ever produced. The city didn't deserve her. I can wait out here all night, you know. It'll be easy. I've got all your wine and all your money.
Gah!
Locke snatched the little leather wallet off the table. He wiggled the fingers of his good right hand and regarded his left hand more dubiously. The broken wrist was mending, but it ached constantly. He bent over the lock mechanism by the door, scowled, and went to work. He was surprised at how quickly the muscles of his back began to protest his uncomfortable posture. He stopped long enough to pull the room's chair over so he could sit on it while he worked. As his picks rattled around inside the lock and he bit his tongue in concentration, he heard the heavy creak of movement outside the door and a series of loud thumps.
Jean?
Still here, Locke, came Jean's voice, now cheerful. Gods, you're taking your sweet time.
Oh, I'm sorry. Have you even started yet? When I get this door open, you're dead, Jean.
When you get that door open? I look forward to many long years of life, then.
Locke redoubled his concentration, falling back into the rhythm he'd learned over so many painstaking hours as a boy, moving the picks slightly, feeling for sensations. That damn creaking and thumping had started up on the other side of the door again. What was Jean playing at now? Locke closed his eyes and tried to block the sound out of his mind, tried to let his world narrow down to the message of the picks against his fingers. The mechanism clicked open. Locke stumbled up from his chair, jubilant and furious, and yanked the door open. Jean had vanished, and the narrow corridor outside the room was packed wall to wall with wooden crates and barrels, an impassable barrier about 3 feet from Locke's face.
Jean, what the hell is this?
I'm sorry, Locke.
Jean was obviously standing directly behind his makeshift wall.
I borrowed a few things from the keeper's larder, and got a few of the boys you cheated at cards last week to help me carry it all up here.
Locke gave the wall a good shove, but it didn't budge. Jean was probably putting his full weight against it. There was a faint chorus of laughter from somewhere on the other side, probably down in the common room. Locke ground his teeth together and beat the flat of his good hand against a barrel.
"What the hell's the matter with you, Jean? You're making a goddamned scene!"
"Not really. Last week I told the keeper you were a Camori don travelling incognito, trying to recover from a bout of madness. Just now I set an awful lot of silver on his bar. You do remember silver, don't you? How we used to steal it from people back when you were pleasant company?"
"This has ceased to amuse me, Jean. Give me back my God's damned wine."
God's damned it is, and I'm afraid that if you want it, you're going to have to climb out your window.
Locke took a step back and stared at the makeshift wall, dumbfounded.
Jean, you can't be serious.
I've never been more serious.
Go to hell! Go to hell! I can't climb out a bloody window. My wrist...
You fought the Grey King with one arm nearly cut off. You climbed out a window 500 feet up in Raven's Reach, and here you are, 3 stories off the ground, helpless as a kitten in a grease barrel. Cry, baby, pissant!
You are deliberately trying to provoke me!
No shit, said Jean. Sharp as a cudgel you are.
Locke stomped back into the room, fuming. He stared at the shuttered window, bit his tongue, and stormed back to Jean's wall.
"Please let me out,"
he said as evenly as he could manage. "Your point is driven home."
"I'd drive it home with a blackened steel pike if I had one," said Jean. "Why are you talking to me when you should be climbing out the window?"
"God damn you!"
Back to the room. Locke paced furiously. He swung his arms about tentatively. The cuts on his left arm ached, and the deep wound on his shoulder still twinged cruelly. His battered left wrist felt as though it might almost serve, pain or no pain. He curled his left-hand fingers into a fist, stared down at them, and then looked up at the window with narrowed eyes.
"Fuck it," he said. "I'll show you a thing or three, you son of a bloody silk merchant!"
Locke tore his bedding apart, knotting sheet ends to blankets, inviting twinges from his injuries. The pain only seemed to drive him on faster. He tightened his last knot, threw open the shutters, and tossed his makeshift rope out the window. He tied the end in his hands to his bed frame. It wasn't a terribly sturdy piece of furniture, but then he didn't weigh all that much. Out the window he went. Velvirazzo was an old, low city. Locke's impressions, as he swung there, three stories above the faintly misted street, came in flashes. Flat-topped, sagging buildings of stone and plaster, reefed sails on black masts in the harbour, white moonlight gleaming on dark water, red lights burning atop glass pylons in a line receding out toward the horizon. Locke shut his eyes, clung to his sheets, and bit his tongue to avoid throwing up. It seemed easiest to simply let himself slide downward. He did so in fits and starts, letting his palms grow warm against the sheets and blankets before stopping. Down 10 feet, 20. He balanced precariously on the top sill of the inn's common room window and gasped in a few deep breaths before continuing. Warm as the night was, he was getting chilly from the soaking he'd received. The last end of the last sheet ended about 6 feet off the ground. Locke slid down as far as he could, then let himself drop. His heels slapped against the cobblestones, and he found that Jean Tannen was already waiting for him, with a cheap grey cloak in his hands. Before Locke could move, Jean flung the cloak around his shoulders.
"You son of a bitch!" cried Locke,
pulling the cloak around himself with both hands.
"You snake-souled, dirty-minded son of a bitch! I hope a shark tries to suck your cock!"
"Why, Master Lamora, look at you," said Jean. "Charming a lock, climbing out a window, almost as though you used to be a thief."
"I was pulling off hanging of fences when you were still teeth on tits in your mother's arms."
"And I've been pulling off hanging of fences while you've been sulking in your room, drinking away your skills."
"I'm the best thief in Velvirazzo," growled Locke. "Drunk or sober, awake or asleep, and you damn well know it."
"I might have believed that once," said Jean, "but that was a man I knew in Camor, and he hasn't been with me for some time."
"God's damn your ugly face!"
yelled Locke as he stepped up to Jean and punched him in the stomach. More surprised than hurt, Jean gave him a solid shove. Locke flew backward, cloak whirling as he tried to keep his balance, until he collided with a man who'd been coming down the street.
"Mind your fucking step!"
The stranger, a middle-aged man in a long orange coat and the prim clothes of a clerk or a law scribe, wrestled for a few seconds with Locke, who clutched at him for support.
"A thousand pardons," said Locke. "A thousand pardons, sir. My friend and I were merely having a discussion. The fault is all mine."
"I dare say it is," said the stranger, at last succeeding in prying Locke from his coat lapels and thrusting him away. "You have breath like a wine cask. Bloody Camorri!"
Locke watched until the man was a good 20 or 30 yards down the street, then whirled back toward Jean, dangling a little black leather purse in the air before him. It jingled with a healthy supply of heavy coins.
"Ha! What do you say to that, hm?"
"I say it was bloody child's play,"
doesn't mean a god's damned thing.
Child's play? Die screaming, Jean. That was...
You're mangy, said Jean. You're dirtier than a Shades Hill orphan. You've lost weight, though where from is a great mystery. You haven't been exercising your wounds or letting anyone tend to them for you. You've been hiding in a room, letting your condition slip away, and you've been drunk for 2 straight weeks. You're not what you were, and it's your own damn fault.
So?
Locke scowled at Jean, slipped the purse into a tunic pocket, and straightened the cloak on his shoulders.
You require a demonstration. Fine. Get back inside and take down your silly wall and wait for me in the room. I'll be back in a few hours.
But Locke had already thrown up the hood of his cloak, turned, and begun to stride down the street into the warm Velvirazzo night. 6. Jean cleared the barrier from the third-floor hallway, left a few more coins from Locke's purse with the bemused innkeeper, and bustled about the room, allowing some of the smell of drunken enclosure to evaporate out the open window. Upon reflection, he went down to the bar and came back with a glass decanter of water. Jean was pacing worriedly when Locke burst back in about 4 hours later, just past the third hour of the morning. He set a huge wicker basket down on the table, threw off his cloak, grabbed the bucket Jean had used to douse him, and noisily threw up in it.
"My apologies,"
he muttered when he finished. He was flushed and breathing heavily, as wet as he'd been when he'd left, but now with warm sweat.
"The wine has not entirely left my head, and my wind has all but deserted me."
Jean passed him the decanter, and Locke slurped from it as shamelessly as a horse at a trough. Jean helped him into the chair. Locke said nothing for a few seconds, then suddenly seemed to notice Jean's hand on his shoulder, and he recoiled.
"Here we are, then," he gasped. "See what happens when you provoke me? I think we're going to have to flee the city."
What have you done?" Locke tore the lid from his basket. It was the sort commonly used by merchants to haul small loads of goods to and from a street market. A prodigious assortment of odds and ends lay inside, and Locke began to list them off as he pulled them out and showed them to Jean.
"What's this? Why, it's a pile of purses. 1, 2, 3, 4 of them, all plucked from sober gentlemen in open streets. Here's a knife, 2 bottles of wine, a pewter ale mug, dented a bit, but still good metal. A brooch, 3 gold pins, 2 earrings. Earrings, Master Tannen, plucked from ears. And I'd like to see you try that. Here's a little bolt of nice silk, a box of sweetmeats, 2 loaves of bread, the crusty kind with all the spices baked in that you like so much. And now, specially for the edification of a certain pessimistic, peace-breaking son of a bitch, who shall remain nameless..."
Locke held up a glittering necklace, a braided band of gold and silver supporting a heavy gold pendant studded with sapphires in the stylized pattern of a floral blossom. The little phalanx of stones flashed like blue fire, even by the light of the room's single soft lantern.
"That's a sweet piece," said Jean,
briefly forgetting to be aggravated.
"You didn't snatch that off a street."
"No," said Locke, before taking another deep draught of the warm water in the decanter. "I got it from the neck of the governor's mistress."
"You can't be serious."
"In the governor's manor."
"Of all the..."
"In the governor's bed."
"Damned lunatic!"
"With the governor sleeping next to her." The night quiet was broken by the high, distant trill of a whistle, the traditional swarming noise of city watches everywhere. Several other whistles joined in a few moments later.
"It is possible," said Locke with a sheepish grin, "that I have been slightly too bold."
Jean sat down on the bed and ran both of his hands through his hair.
"Locke, I've spent the past few weeks making a name for Tavern Callous as the biggest,
brightest thing to come along in this city's sad little pack of right people for ages. When the watch starts asking questions, someone's going to point me out, and someone's going to mention all the time I spend here and the time I spend with you. And if we try to fence a piece of metal like that in a place this small... As I said, I think we're going to have to flee the city.
Flee the city?
Jean jumped up and pointed an accusatory finger at Locke.
You've screwed up weeks of work. I've been training the coves. Signals, tricks, teasing, fighting, the whole bit. I was going to start teaching them how to cook.
Ooh, this is serious. I take it the marriage proposal wasn't far behind.
Damn it, this is serious. I've been building something. I've been out working while you've been sobbing and sulking and pissing your time away in here.
You're the one who lit a fire under me because he wanted to see me dance. Now I've danced and I believe I've made my point. Will you be apologizing?
Apologizing? You're the one who's been an insufferable little shit. Letting you live is apology enough. All my work...
Capa of Velverazzo? Is that how you saw yourself, Jean? Another Barsavi?
Another anything, said Jean. There's worse things to be. Capa la Mora, for example. Lord of one smelly room. I won't be a bloody knockabout, Locke. I am an honest working thief, and I'll do what I have to keep a roof over our heads.
So let's go somewhere and get back to something really lucrative, said Locke. You want honest, crooked work? Fine. Let's go hook a big fish, just like we used to in Camor. You wanted to see me steal? Let's go out and steal.
But Tavrin Callas...
has died before, said Locke. Seeker into Azaguia's mysteries, right? Let him seek again.
Damn it!
Jean stepped over to the window and took a peek out. There was still whistling coming from several directions.
It might take a few days to arrange a berth on a ship, and we won't get out by land with what you've stolen. They'll be checking everyone at the gates, probably for a week or two to come.
Jean, said Locke, now you're disappointing me.
Gates? Ships? Please, this is us we're talking about. We could smuggle a live cow past every constable in this city at high noon, without clothes.
Locke, Locke Lamora, Jean rubbed his eyes with exaggerated motions.
Why, where have you been all these weeks? Here I thought I'd been rooming with a miserable, self-absorbed asshole who...
Right, said Locke. Fine. Huh. Yeah, maybe I deserved that kick in the face, but I'm serious. Getting us out is as easy as a bit of cooking. Get down to the innkeeper. Wake him up and throw some more silver at him. There's plenty in those purses. I'm a mad Camori don, right? Tell him I've got a mad whim. Get me some more dirty cloth, some apples, a hearthstone, and a black iron pot full of water.
Apples? Jean scratched his beard. Apples? You mean the apple mash trick?
Just so, said Locke. Get me that stuff, and I'll get boiling, and we can be out of here by dawn.
Huh.
Jean opened the door, slipped out into the hall, and turned once before leaving for good.
I take some of it back, he said. You might still be a lying, cheating, low-down, greedy, grasping, conniving, pocket-picking son of a bitch.
Thanks, said Locke. 7. A drizzle was pattering softly around them as they walked out through Velverazzo's north gate a few hours later. Sunrise was a watery line of yellow on the eastern horizon, under scudding charcoal clouds. Purple-jacketed soldiers stared down in revulsion from atop the city's 15-foot wall. The heavy wooden door of the small sallyport slammed shut behind them, as though it too was glad to be quit of them. Locke and Jean were both dressed in tattered cloaks, and wrapped in bandage-like fragments from a dozen torn-up sheets and pieces of clothing.
A thin coating of boiled apple mash, still warm, soaked through some of the bandages on their arms and chests, and was plastered liberally over their faces. Sloshing around, wearing a layer of the stuff under cloth was disgusting, but there was no better disguise to be had in all the world. Slipskin was a painful, incurable disease, and those afflicted with it were even less tolerated than lepers. Had Locke and Jean approached from outside Velverazzo's walls, they never would have been let in. As it was, the guards had no interest in how they'd entered the city in the first place. They'd nearly stumbled over themselves in their haste to see them gone. The outer city was an unhappy-looking place, a few blocks of crumbling one- and two-story buildings, decorated here and there with the makeshift windmill towers favoured in these parts for driving bellows over forges and ovens. Smoke sketched a few curling grey lines in the wet air overhead, and thunder rumbled in the distance. Beyond the city, where the cobbles of the old Therin Throne Road became a wet dirt track, Locke could see scrubland, interrupted here and there by rocky clefts and piles of debris. Their coins, and all of their other small goods worth transporting, were tucked into a little bag tied under Jean's clothes, where no guardsman would dare search, not even if a superior stood behind him with a drawn sword and ordered it on pain of death. "Gods!" Locke muttered as they trudged along beside the road. "I'm getting too tired to think straight. I really have let myself slouch out of condition." "Well," said Jean, "you're going to get some exercise these next few days, whether you like it or not. How are the wounds?" "They itch," said Locke. "This damn mush does them little good, I suspect. Still, it's not as bad as it was. A few hours of motion seems to have had some benefit." "Wise in the ways of all such things is Jean Tannen," said Jean. "Wiser by far than most, especially most named Lamora." "Shut your fat, ugly, inarguably wiser face," said Locke. "Look at those idiots scamper away from us." "Would you do otherwise if you saw a pair of real slip-skinners by the side of the road?" "Eh? I suppose not. Damn these aching feet, too. Let's get a mile or two outside town, then find a place to rest. Once they've put some leagues under our heels, we can ditch this mush and pose as respectable travellers again. Any idea where you want to strike out for?" "I should have thought it was obvious," said Locke. "These little towns are for pikers. We're after gold and white iron, not clipped coppers. Let's make for Tal Verar. Something's bound to present itself there." "Tal Verar. Well, it's close. Camori have a long and glorious history of kicking the piss out of our poor Verari cousins. So I say, on to Tal Verar," said Locke. "And glory!" They walked on a ways under the tickling mist of the morning drizzle. "And baths." Chapter 2 Requin 1 Though Locke saw that Jean remained as unsettled by their experience in the night market as he was, they spoke no further of the matter. There was a job to be done, and they were up at the crack of dusk the next day. The close of the working day for honest men and women in Tal Verar was just the beginning of theirs. It had been strange at first, getting used to the rhythm of a city where the sun simply fell beneath the horizon like a quiescent murder victim each night, without the glow of false light to mark its passing. But Tal Verar had been built to different tastes or needs than Camor, and its elderglass simply mirrored the sky, raising no light of its own. Their suite at the Villa Candessa was high-ceilinged and opulent. At 5 silver volani a night, nothing less was to be expected. Their fourth-floor window overlooked a cobbled courtyard in which carriages, studded with lanterns and outriding mercenary guards, came and went with echoing clatters. "Bonds, Magi," muttered Jean as he tied on his neckcloths before a looking-glass. "I'll never hire one of the bastards to do so much as heat my tea, not if I live to be richer than the Duke of Camor." "Now there's a thought,"
said Locke, who was already dressed and sipping coffee. A full day of sleep had done wonders for his head. If we were richer than the Duke of Camor, we could hire a whole pack of them and give them instructions to go lose themselves on a desolate fucking island somewhere.
I don't think the gods made any islands desolate enough for my tastes.
Jean finished his neckcloths with one hand and reached for his breakfast with the other. One of the odder services the Villa Candessa provided for its long-term guests was its likeness cakes, little frosted simulacra fashioned after the guests by the inn's Camor-trained pastry sculptor. On a silver tray beside the looking-glass, a little sweetbread lock, with raisin eyes and almond-butter blonde hair, sat beside a rounder Jean with dark chocolate hair and beard. The baked Jean's legs were already missing. A few moments later, Jean was brushing the last buttery crumbs from the front of his coat.
"Alas, poor Locke and Jean."
"They died of consumption," said Locke.
"I do wish I could be there to see it when you talk to Requin and Selendri, you know."
"Can I trust you to still be in Tal Vahrar by the time I get finished?" He tried to leaven the question with a smile, only partially succeeding.
"You know I won't go anywhere," said Jean. "I'm still not sure it's wise, but you know I won't."
"I do. I'm sorry." He finished his coffee and set the cup down. "And my chat with Requin isn't going to be that terribly interesting."
"Nonsense. I heard a smirk in your voice. Other people smirk when their work is finished. You grin like an idiot just before yours really begins."
"Smirking? I'm as slack-cheeked as a corp.